All right. Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight we've assembled another special group of special spirits to help us bring in another top 10 in our ongoing series of the top 10 whatever of Mormonism. And so let's start and introduce our illustrious panel. First of all, to my right is the lovely and talented Zilpha. Hey, Zilpha.
Hey, everybody. Happy to be here.
We're happy to have you here.
I'm always happy to be in my own house.
All right. And then we're bringing it in from the four corners of the world again. First of all, returning is Jesse. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Mike. Or sorry. Hey, John.
Oh, I see where this is going to go tonight. You know, Mike and I have a lot of things in common. We both
I just get you. I just get you so confused sometimes. Sometimes I can't even tell who's talking.
How many podcasts have you been on now?
I think this is number 4. Let's see. I did submit an essay this time, so if that counts, then it would be 5. I was on the Pullman episode. I was on the Abrahamic Covenant episode, and I was on the Backslider.
Oh, okay. Episode. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
And also returning is Brant. Hey, Brant.
Hey, John. How's it going?
I'm doing well. Now, is this your second time or third?
I think this is second with you. I've done a couple with Glenn. I did one with Heather that's still in the pipeline there. So I'm not sure what I'm up to yet.
All right. Remember, when you get your fifth one in, you need to submit your bio for the page.
Yep.
Okay. And Brant, for our discussion today, I wanted to kind of run the gamut. I have on the way left of, you know, just people who are way out there, Zilpha. And then I'm moving in towards the middle a little bit on the, what side should I say? Is it the left or the right? Why are you looking at me like that? And then, Jesse, you're kind of, you used to go to church, but I don't know, maybe characterize your belief pattern for our.
Oh, man. Active non-believer, not out, but trying to make things work, trying to not destroy my life, but also, you know, I've got a lot of reasons to stay in, and I'm caught in the middle, being tugged both ways, so not
right.
Comfortable.
Fair enough.
And did you say it's uncomfortable?
It's very uncomfortable. My garments are chafing right now.
And Brant, you are a believer, right?
I'm a believer. I'm still in. I'm actually in an Elder's Quorum presidency and still going to the temple and all that fun stuff.
All right. Well, thanks for helping us out tonight, guys. Tonight our top 10 topic is one that I've been looking forward to. We're going to talk about the top 10 uniquely Mormon doctrines or uniquely Mormon ideas. Of course, you know, Mormonism was born, you know, in an American movement of religion and shares a lot of characteristics with other religions that came about from the time. But there are some ideas that have sprung up that are really uniquely Mormon. And I'm afraid that most people don't know what those are. People in the church, I know I even speak for myself. I studied quite a bit when I was a member of the church, but I didn't necessarily understand what everybody else believed. People outside definitely don't understand what Mormons believe. You know, they'll characterize Mormons as, oh, what, polygamy? And if you talk about Mormons, what else will they
and
come
And they
up
want with? To become gods? Mormons.
Yeah, they'll usually know that one, and then they'll know magic underwear, right?
Yeah. And you can't drink coffee.
Yeah, no coffee. Though, interestingly enough, the no coffee is more well-known than the no beer thing. I wonder if some of our Mormon brethren are not being as faithful as we would hope.
I think that's a workplace phenomenon.
Maybe so. All right. So anybody have any comments on our topic before we jump right in at number 10?
Well, I just mentioned this, but we're taking the top 10 uniquely Mormon doctrines as we sit today. That's our perspective. But if you go back at any point during the history of the church, these top 10 would have been completely rearranged or would have been, you know, different doctrines altogether based on what was being emphasized at the time, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I excluded anything from the list that has been abandoned. You know, for example, and people would argue whether or not it's been abandoned, but sort of abandoned in the mainstream, something like Blood Atonement or Adam God, you know, those aren't held by the majority of the membership, and the church definitely doesn't teach them. So we've excluded doctrines like that.
And I also think that all these doctrines are going to come out, especially as it looks like, just from articles I'm reading, that Mitt's getting closer and closer to being the front runner for the GOP. I think that we're going to be hearing about these more and more and more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So as a service to all of our Gentile brothers and sisters out there who want to get an understanding of what makes Mitt and his sort of half-ass friend,
Huntsman,
Mormon, here's your top 10 list. All right.
So Mormon Expression is now the guiding star for the country's future, is what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. We have in the works a guide to Mormonism that we'll release with a press release to all the Gentiles, so that they can they can definitely follow along in their own books. All right. Let's start. No further ado. Number 10, the Three Kingdoms of Glory and No Hell. Of course, when Joseph Smith in the Nauvoo period introduced this doctrine, it was a radical shift from Protestant and Catholic teaching on the afterlife, in that he was describing three kingdoms of glory, meaning three heavens, in which basically everyone would receive some form of goodness. And it did away with the secular concept of this eternal punishment in hell, that almost all the children of mankind were destined for some sort of greatness.
Some sort of salvation. But, you know, the outer darkness concept is almost worse than hell. Like, I mean, it's something that you can imagine. Like, I can't imagine burning in fire forever, but I can imagine being, like, forever cut off from like, anybody else's presence.
Yeah, but outer darkness does not, you know, it basically reintroduces the concept of hell, you're right, but it's reserved for apostates, really. And so, you know, it doesn't have this, well, I guess religion has to inspire people to work, to sacrifice now, either morally or financially or whatever, for some future reward on the top side and some punishment on the bottom side. And Mormon outer darkness is only reserved for apostates, really.
Right.
So it's not that reward punishment scenario that most religions rely on.
And going along with this, Joseph also got rid of the devil with horns and a tail. Mormons believe in a more human devil.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think most Christians still kind of believe in some kind of boogeyman devil, not some person kind of like us.
I wanted to add on this one that Glenn Ostlund had a really great way of explaining it, but I think this doctrine came almost completely out of that passage in, what is it, 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul's saying, you know, there's one glory of the sun, and there's another of the moon, and there's another of the stars, and there's bodies celestial, and there's bodies telestial. Well, he was really saying, he was making a point how there's things that are heavenly and there's things that are earthly, but he threw in that little part about there's ones like the sun and ones like the moon and ones like the stars. And he was really saying all of those are heaven. And then here we are on earth. But Joseph Smith took that and ran with it and said, you know, that's what heaven is like. And now you've got this, you know, the Mormons have just exploded that, you know, half of a verse in one passage to now that's what the afterlife is all about.
Well, there's that verse, and there's the other verse, and I'm not a New Testament scholar, but Paul basically refers to the third heaven.
Right.
So I, you know, Joseph loved to mash up, like all great writers of this genre do, mash up different ideas and put a new twist on them. And that's what, you know, he would riff on a couple things in the Bible and use that to lay down his foundation.
You know, even though this is a really uniquely Mormon doctrine, if I take a step back from Mormonism, I look at it, I think it's a really inspiring way to look at the afterlife, just because you don't, aside from outer darkness, you don't have to worry about going to a burning hell where you know your life is going to be horrible and torturous. I mean, there's different degrees, there's different ways that you can experience the afterlife compared to either, you know, one or the other.
You know, I can see that, and when I was growing up a Mormon, that definitely was emphasized that the old Christian model of heaven and hell is so binary and it doesn't fit the nuances of the world. you know, and all the different things and all the different ways people act. So we have a ternary system. It's still just equally as absurd to me. You know, it's like there's billions and billions of people, and say okay, two kingdoms is way too little, so we have a third, and so, you know, we're really taking care of it. I think it's still as fundamentally screwed up as the heaven and hell binary.
Yeah, but it's a little better. Especially
it's one better,
the concept,
I guess.
Yeah. That they're all in a sense a salvation state. I mean, like Joseph said, that even the lowest, the third kingdom, is going to be better than it is here. So everybody's going to have it better than they have it here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it puts the different degrees on. Look, if you live your life, you know, good, you're going to go to one. If you live it better, you're going to go to another. And if you live it the best possible, you're going to go to the other. I mean, it sounds really, I don't want to be selfish, but honestly, if I'm going to sit here and I'm going to live my life the best possible, and I'm going to be next to someone who really could care less, but we're both going to go to the same place, that's going to be a little disheartening, at least knowing that I'm going to go someplace where there's going to be other people who actually tried to live the same way that I did.
Isn't that – but if you think that way, that's always going to be the case. Like, you know, you say, okay, in this class, some students got Ds, Cs, Bs, and As. And then all the A students sit over here. It won't take long for the A student said, well, I had a 95%, and this guy only had a 92%. He didn't study as much as I did. So all the 95%ers go sit next to each other. And pretty soon they're like, well, I know that I would study on Saturdays, and this guy – you can just endlessly play that game. But when would you ever be satisfied? Because you'd always look around and say, dude, I'm better than these bastards here behind me. Why are they in the same place I am?
Well, that's
I think to some extent Mormonism corrects for that, because they say, you know, in God's house there are many mansions, and there's 3 degrees within the celestial degree.
Right, and then the black servants, the, you know, the really righteous black people are going to be servants.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Those who don't marry get the bottom of the top. Yeah. So.
Hey, Brant, was that a Tom sigh? That was good.
Yeah, it was. I tried to stifle it, but I couldn't help myself.
Okay. The other thing I think worth mentioning before we move on is this doctrine also shows a really interesting mark between early Joseph Smith teachings and late Joseph Smith teachings. Early teachings in the Book of Mormon and from the 1830s were very anti-universalist. And mm-hmm. by the time we got to the Nauvoo period, Mormonism had come full circle and embraced a more universalist perspective. And Joseph Smith, during the Nauvoo period, was very tolerant of others. You know, it's pointed out that on the Council of 50, there were 3 non-members. And, you know, he went out of his way and famously said, you know, we will have Muslims here and whoever else. They don't have to be Christian. So I think this is one of the leftover pieces from Joseph Smith's universalistic embrace, which I think is a great thing. Okay. Number 9, the temples. Which one of you wants to explain the Mormon? Brant, you're a believer. Why don't you give us the nutshell? What do Mormons believe about the temples?
All right. This is interesting because my wife actually had this question a couple of days ago. Basically, a temple is a further place of worship. A temple is a place where we're going to go to actually perform rituals and ceremonies describing our worship. And it's really a higher place where we can feel closer and more connected to God. And there's going to be things happening in there. Such as not only ordinances for ourselves and living ordinances, but there will be things like endowments, things like baptisms for those that have passed on. Plus, we can do all these things by proxy for people who have passed on, as well as sealings.
And what is a sealing according to Mormons? I mean,
assuming... a sealing is a wedding ceremony that's actually going to bind you and your partner, that you two will continue on together for all eternity, and that your family will be bound to you, and that they will always be bound together.
Well, and it's not just marriage. Children are still sealed to their parents, yeah, even to today. I think that's a good review. And I want to point out, you know, why it's unique. You know, in the Judaic tradition where the temple originated, you know, and Christ, of course, spent time in the temple. The temple was like the pinnacle place where man and God touched. So it'd be very strange under the Judaic tradition to have multiple temples, or the Mormon concept of temples dotting the earth. And the ceremonies that were performed in the temple were often performed for the people collectively, you know, to unite with their one true God, of course, they being monotheistic.
And weren't the temples mostly reserved for priests and...
There was a priest of class. There was an outer court where, you know, you could come and bring your sacrifices for your sins or whatever. But then as you went into the inner, you know, the inner chambers, that there was beseeching on behalf of the people altogether. And then, there, of course, there was the mercy seat, which was the dwelling place of God. And some of those concepts still sort of fall out in like the Salt Lake Temple and some of the early temples. But I mean, the ones they're building now, they're basically sort of indistinguishable from a movie theater. So there's not really that concept of here's the Holy of Holies or here's the place where man communes with God. Brant, you going to let my movie theater comment just slide?
Well, there's always the Holy of Holies, I mean, for the worshipers to go to the celestial room.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking. And look, I mean, yes, there's movie theater style seats in there and they play a movie. But while I disagree with you saying movie theaters, you know, just a movie theater, I mean, they are pretty similar. The outside structure is different and the way that you're going to get in and go to the different places is different, but they're all pretty similar. And I think that's a good thing. That being able to have a homogenous temple that, you know, some of these newer temples, it gives people a sense of like they've been there before.
It's like the Walmart of religion.
I want to make sure I'm not misleading. The Holy of Holies is not in the Mormon temples, the dwelling place of God. The Holy of Holies is the room that's reserved for the second anointing. But nevertheless, there are, you know, sacred spaces, especially in the older temples. I think there's two other things about the Mormon temple that are worth pointing out. First one, in comparison to Protestantism, you know, Protestantism sort of rejected the idea of the necessary ordinance and necessary works, and more took on the embrace of the spirit of the action, you know, i.e. baptism or whatever, where they'll acknowledge one another's baptism. So the idea of the temple is very foreign to a Protestant, and we'll kind of get back into that a little bit here down the list. But I also think compared to Catholicism, you know, there were grand cathedrals and there were all sorts of ceremony, but they were very open to the public. Where for Mormons, the temple is very much a sacred space where not even most Mormons can go. And you must do some things, you know, primarily they're abstained from certain things. You know, right now it's abstained from like coffee and alcohol and
sex outside of marriage
where not that many years ago, you know, you had to abstain from sex with your own spouse for a certain amount of time. So there's that abstinence of purification as well as the sacrifice of paying tithing to get in, where not all members are willing or able to do that.
And children aren't allowed in.
Yeah, children are allowed into the part of the temple. Teenagers are allowed to do baptisms for the dead, but
and small children are allowed to go in just for sealings to their parents.
Correct. Well, it's not small children. All children.
Right, all the way
up to 18. Yeah.
But I'm saying teenagers have other things that they can do there, but not much.
Yeah, you're right.
So let me throw this out there, because we're all at different ends of the Mormon spectrum. You know, I've noticed that for people that are either on their way out of Mormonism or completely out, the temple is something that's really something that's, it's a very sensitive spot. And I guess I'll just throw it out there with this. Is it okay? Because I look at it and say, you know what? Mormons have a very sacred place where they do very sacred ordinances and they do things to feel closer with God. Where's a lot of the venom that comes from the other side to Mormons having temples?
You mean where's the source of the anger?
I don't understand it.
From insider, are you talking about from apostates or outsiders? Because I have a different answer for either one.
Well, let's go with both. Let's start with insiders and then go to outsiders.
For the apostates, a lot of it comes from the fact that, well, I'll give it in terms of me. You know, when I was preparing to go on my mission, and everybody I know had gone to the temple, and I, you know, I'd done all the stuff to prepare, I went through. It was not a religious experience for me that time. It later became more sacred for me, but it wasn't in the beginning. It was very strange. It was very jarring. And I went home thinking, I have no idea what church I'm in. Because all this stuff that I'd never been told about was suddenly thrust upon me. All these costumes and things, rites of the priesthood and
commitments that you have to do.
Commitments that I didn't understand. And it went by and there were punishments of a grave nature and all sorts of all sorts of stuff like that. And I was just like, holy crap, what? I don't even understand. I remember just laying in bed that night thinking, I do not understand my religion. So I think that sort of disconcerting, that otherness, that there's two Mormonisms, there's the Mormonism they talk about, and there's the Mormonism they don't talk about, I think that is offsetting to a lot of people.
Well, and also for apostates, they are excluded from family events, yes, and that can be painful, and therefore some people get angry about being excluded from, you know, a sister's wedding or something like that.
Yes, the temple very much represents that, the exclusionary nature of Mormonism, that you like Zilpha said, you can't do that, or because you haven't paid tithing, and a lot of people have stories of wanting to go and bishops withholding that for this reason or that reason. So the temple represents sort of the pinnacle of the Mormon experience, and it's the first thing that's denied to people who are having struggles of faith.
Well, but is it a bad thing, though? I mean, look, if the temple... I mean, well, hold on, though, because I sit here and I look at the temple as a place that's really spiritual and a place where, honestly, I go and I feel extremely close to God and have awesome spiritual experiences. Is it a bad thing to say, you know what, you're not living up to the standards that are set to go in the temple, and in order to go into a temple, a place where many Mormons consider it to be extremely sacred, you have to live to a certain standard? I mean, is that a bad thing?
Absolutely.
Well, what if you are living to that standard, but you just can't believe?
Well, I mean, let's...
What if your only sin is that you can't believe?
But isn't that one of the first two questions, though, in the temple recommend interviews?
Yeah, that's the problem. So, I mean, but you could be worthy in every other way.
But if you can't answer that first question, those first couple of questions based on belief, then you could be worthy. But in a sense, it's almost like you don't have the correct spirit going in there. You know what I mean?
Well,
so because if you don't believe those first couple of questions, which are based on God and the prophets and Joseph Smith, then why are you going in the temple?
If it was purely a Mormon thing,
to be part of your family.
You know, just recently, Zilpha's sister was married, and this was her sister, somebody she was very close to. You know, they'd grown up together. Zilpha was unable to go to her sister's wedding. That is cultish behavior, to take and divide something that is so fundamental. I mean, if people listed in American culture and probably all around the world the very most important things of the family life, you know, it'd be funerals, it would be births, it'd be weddings. I mean, that is of paramount importance to the bonds of family. And the church comes in and starts with that, and that's going to get people upset.
You got a potty mouth.
Oh, sorry. I'll bleep that one. But
can I add a 30-second answer to that?
Sure.
What pissed me off and still pisses me off is that I went to the temple for years frequently, and, you know, before my mission, after everything, and I never understood what was going on because there's no explanation for what's going on. And it just made no sense, but, you know, it's this kind of spooky, mysterious thing, and you just kind of go and do it. And then when I started having doubts and started researching and learning about stuff, then it all made sense. and then I'm like, okay, well, now I understand why, you know, I did this thing with my hand, and I understand why this guy said this to me. And it's just a total mind job that there's however many, you know, a couple million active members of the church going to the temple on a regular basis that have absolutely no clue what they're doing. And the reason they have no clue what they're doing is because the church is more or less ashamed of the roots of the temple ceremony. That's what's, it's sad to me that, you know, I'll tell you, for example, someone in my family who's very close to me, we were just talking and he just threw something out like, yeah, what does that mean at the temple? Or what is that symbol, you know, mean? And I could have told him all about it, but it would have shattered his belief. And I'm like, yeah, weird, right? You know, I mean,
yeah, but you know what, though? I mean, honestly, Jesse, I sit here, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I know all those things. But, you know, even knowing that, I can still have a spiritual experience in there. And oh, and that's, I guess that's my biggest thing is I just sit there and go, you know, I understand to a sense, as far as apostates go, they view the temple as kind of, like John said, the culmination of being excluded from everything. And Zilpha, look, I don't know much about your family, but I know people that have understood that was going to be an issue and have actually done ceremonies outside the temple so that people could be involved.
Yeah, but they're not supposed to, according to the church.
Well, I from what I've seen, they're changing that. That is being changed because I'm seeing it happen more and more.
Maybe people are just ignoring it.
Well, they could be, or it could be falling under the discretion of bishops who realize that this could be a serious issue for people if they're blatantly excluded like that. But the problem I have is, again, it's something that I view as you know, yeah, it's a little weird when you first go in and everything like that, especially because it's so completely foreign to what we have in our church services. Mm-hmm. But even the Catholics, they have their sit and listen type services, and then they have their get up and actively participate. I guess we could go round and round on this temple thing for another hour, but something that I've never understood.
I'll add that I generally found the temple to be sort of a spiritual experience for me. It was kind of boring. They could, if they just cut out everything they repeated, they could cut it down from 2.5 hours to like 45 minutes. I mean, and for those who haven't been through temple, I mean, I'm not exaggerating. They just say the exact same thing usually four times, and it gets sort of old.
Did you want to talk about why outsiders?
Oh
have
yeah,
a
the outsiders. Okay, so the other thing I mentioned was the outsiders. My opinion is why the outsiders don't like the temple is it's clearly an ostentatious display of wealth. The temples.
Oh, come on.
Go drive Washington D.C. or San Diego. You have temples that are built out of the finest material that money can buy. They light them up like floodlights at a football game. No one is going outside is going to interpret it any other way. You can watch the church's publication material, and they brag about importing mahogany and rare marble and all this sort of stuff. One of the reasons I say this is I was on my mission in San Diego when the San Diego Temple went up in La Jolla, which is San Diego is one of the most expensive cities in the United States, and that's like the prime real estate that they built on, and it looks like this. It looks like a castle from another, like a science fantasy movie, and it's just white and it's glowing and there's so many I don't know what they used to describe light, but it's just lit up like nothing else around, and what message is the church trying to convey?
Honestly, I think the church is trying to convey this is a place that's extremely spiritual. We want to show our respect for God and respect for everything that he's given us. So we are going to make this with the best material that's out there. I mean, isn't that the way that they've always tried to that religious people have always tried to show sacrifice and devotion to God is by giving the best?
Maybe some people see it that way, but I think a lot of religious people don't. And if you look in the American Protestant tradition, there is a long tradition of building humble, simple structures, as opposed to the sort of the Catholic tradition of sinking every penny of wealth into it. So there's some people who say, wow, whatever church spends the most money on their architecture, that's the true one. And there's other people who say, wow, for me, when I read the New Testament, I just can't square that idea. Based on the teachings of Jesus, the idea of, hey, if we want to worship God, we're going to build the most expensive building we possibly can. But, that's my take on why people from the outside. Read D.C., Washington, D.C. stuff. About every year, somebody makes a comment on how it's sort of gaudy and over the top the building is.
Yeah, but you could say the same thing about some of the evangelical megachurches.
And they do say the same thing.
Yeah, so, all right, good.
So I mean, your defense is it's okay because Mormons doing the same thing evangelicals do.
I'm saying I don't understand the backlash against Mormons when evangelicals do the same thing, because you know why? If we had a little hut with a couple of sticks and some tarp that we threw over, we'd be getting the exact opposite. They're doing these extremely spiritual and extremely sacred rituals here, and it looks like a piece of crap.
I'll give you the reason then, Brant, or from my perspective, why an outsider would be upset with the temple. And it's because they're baptizing Holocaust victims and Martin Luther and, people whose lives have been Mother Teresa and people whose lives have been very spiritual. And yet here's the Mormons saying, well, that was good, but not quite good enough. So we'll take care of it.
Well,
that upsets a lot of people.
So. Yeah. And that one wasn't a fun one to talk about when people who know that I'm Mormon found out about that. That wasn't an easy one to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but rest assured that St. Francis of Assisi has been baptized into the Mormon Church. All right. Let's move forward. All right. We're going slow today, but that's good. I think we're a lot of good stuff here. Okay, number eight, the Book of Mormon and Christ in America. Zilpha, you want to explain why the Book of Mormon is uniquely Mormon?
Well, because I guess an outsider would see it as an attempt to add to the Bible. It's another set of scriptures that no one else besides the Mormons would consider scriptures.
Yeah, I mean, that's if you're in the Restoration Movement, tracing back to Joseph Smith, then generally the hallmark test is whether or not you accept the Book of Mormon as scripture, and nobody else does. That's a uniquely Mormon thing. There's no way around it. And the reason I wanted to list specifically about Christ in America is the Book of Mormon does, and I'm sure I'll get pushed back on this one. The Book of Mormon does not have very many unique doctrines in it. There's a couple of nuanced things, but really, if you take all the other stuff on this list, none of it appears in the Book of Mormon. So
I was going to make the exact same point.
That's what I mean. There, the doctrines and the
great
teachings,
apostasy.
Nope.
Nah.
It's not there.
Doesn't it? Don't they?
Wait, you're skipping. No, it's not. It's not in the Book of Mormon.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. So, but the one thing that is really interesting, and we'll return to this in number six, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, is Christ in America, which is sort of the idea that Christ's ministry stretched out across the globe. And the Book of Mormon itself says that it wasn't just Christ in Jerusalem and then Christ in the New World. It was Christ in Jerusalem, Christ in the New World, then Christ at least in one other place with the Lost Ten Tribes.
I can wait. You know, I'll go listen to All American from the Book of Mormon soundtrack.
Yeah, and we'll get to that number six.
You know, while the Book of Mormon doesn't introduce a lot of this stuff on here, the Book of Mormon also really expands a lot on some other topics. I mean, it expands a lot on faith. It expands a lot on atonement. So it's not just a throwaway book.
But faith and atonement are generic Christian ideas that every other Christian religion is going to have some flavor of. There's nothing about temple work. There's nothing about ceilings. There's nothing about two different levels of priesthood. There's nothing about, you know, I mean,
yeah, like maybe
the 1830s Mormonism didn't have much of distinctly Mormon doctrine in it.
So maybe let me ask this question. What do we know about the atonement from the Book of Mormon that other Christian thinkers don't believe or understand? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Right. And if you want to get into that, I mean, there's even parts of the Book of Mormon that blatantly contradict other things on our list, like the hell idea. You know, you read Alma, and he's talking about the traditional Christian idea of hell. He's not talking about the Mormon idea of hell at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
It totally puts current Mormonism on its head.
And I think the really interesting thing about the Book of Mormon also is that it was sort of an attempt to combine ideas from the Old Testament with ideas from the New Testament and like make this synthesis
of those
two things.
Yeah, the brilliant or the interesting part of the Book of Mormon is it's like American folklore, things like Campbellite theology.
Well, and it's got the violence of the Old Testament with the charity of the New Testament.
And Greek mythology and, you know, Greek philosophy and, you know, all these ideas that were floating around at the time sort of mishmashed together. And it's a fascinating sort of insight in a 19th century folk religion. Plus all that stuff about Mesoamerica, right?
Well, I don't know about Mesoamerica.
A softball there, Brent.
I know. I'm
sorry. Anyways. I feel like I'm beating up on you today.
Well, like we said, the Book of Mormon has a lot of interesting things about it. It's not a throwaway book.
I think Mormonism has some great things in it. And the Book of Mormon's pretty mediocre. I'm being dead serious here. It's just not a lot of Mormonism as we worship today is based on the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon today really only serves as a signifier that Joseph Smith is a prophet.
Well, and it's got a lot of the follow the prophet kinds of verses in there that can be very useful to Mormons today. That's like the main theme of Mormonism today is follow the prophet. And there are a lot of those stories in the Book of Mormon.
Weren't there a lot of those stories, though, in the Old Testament, too?
Yes, that's what... Yes, and that's why I was saying that it's kind of an attempt to combine or to bring back those elements of the Old Testament into a more modern
I agree.
Version.
But, you know, we're glossing over that second part with Christ in America, which is a big deal. And we'll return to the big deal at number six. Let's go on to number seven, the preexistence. Now, here's a doctrine that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
And
here we go. All right.
I know Sterling McMurrin really liked this one, and some other philosophers, because this sort of goes back to Socrates. Socrates argued this one very strongly, that our ability to reason and to put things together, and there was sort of an innateness in our thought patterns that suggested that, you know, our selves are older than our birth years. And so it's an idea that's been kicking around for about 2,400 years.
So when Mormons say the preexistence, let's define what they mean by that.
Okay, Jesse, why don't you give us the shakedown of Mormon preexistence?
Okay, well, in the plan of salvation lesson, you're always going to get a little squiggly line drawn in the upper left corner, and then there's a little cloudy circle up in the upper left corner, and that's where we all were before we came here. So our spirits, or at least our intelligences, were eternal. And before we came here, we were, you know, we knew each other and we hung out and we talked and all that Saturday's Warrior kind of stuff. And
we were
then
born.
Eventually we get shipped down here.
We were born as spirits.
And we had,
before we right. were born as like physical beings.
And we had agency yes. and the ability to sin.
Yeah. And we chose to come here knowing that it was going to be hard. And we had a whole nother life before this.
Yeah, a whole nother one. And according to the Book of Abraham, or is it Moses? I don't know. Somewhere in the Pro-Great Price, it's important that it allowed for all the spirits to distinguish themselves on their ability and talent. And so at the top of the heap, you have the spirit Jehovah, who would become Jesus Christ, followed shortly thereon by Lucifer, who would become the devil, and then all the rest of us go in line somewhere behind Abraham. And that in a karmic sort of Eastern philosophy way, determined where we're born and what color, say, our skin is.
Oh, gosh. Let me throw this out there to deter from the skin color question. Are Mormons the only ones who have this concept of a you know, we lived before we came to Earth? I'm really not sure if other religions have it.
Eastern religions all have that idea.
Some kind of intelligence that
of reincarnation and the
continuation
long journey of the soul. I've read some that suggest there were some minor thinking in, you know, Judaism and stuff on reincarnation and things like that. But
actually looking and being exactly like we are here, except not in a physical state, I think that's pretty uniquely Mormon, that we were actually born as spirits. And then that spirit is pretty much exactly what you see here on Earth. Like, we don't change form.
You mean anatomically similar?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Things
right.
like
we
gender.
We are us. We are who we are.
Yeah. Now, Brent, you groaned when I said race.
You didn't want you to get back to that one.
And I know that's something the church is trying to distance itself from. You know, I have two books on my shelf by Boyd K. Packer. It's the same title book. One was published in 1979. The other was published 2 years ago. And they cut all that stuff out of the book about our preexistence determining where we are in our race. So it's an idea that is right now being exegized,
weeded
from the,
out
from the, but it was something that was taught rather openly for many, many years by prophets, seers, and revelators.
It's one of
nice
those
dramatic pause there.
just so common sense kind of doctrine.
So
that people kind of they liked.
So Brant, what is your discomfort with me saying that?
My discomfort is seriously, I look at the whole concept of blacks in the priesthood. And personally, I sit there and say, I think that was a product of the time. I think that was the folk doctrine and everything else mixed into it. And it was, look, Mormons weren't the only ones who were prejudiced against black people. I mean, that's a fact.
True. So, yeah, I agree. But I do have to, it's become a mission of mine. I do have to correct every time people say blacks in the priesthood. It wasn't just blacks in the priesthood. Black women were not allowed in the temple, and blacks were not allowed to pray in the churches. So it went beyond.
Yeah, but women weren't allowed to pray in church until the 70s.
They were, but just not in sacrament meeting.
Right. Yeah.
So I mean, the exclusion of.
But it seems like if you have the true church with God running the show, that you should be ahead of the world and things like that, not behind.
That's a good point, but it's probably a discussion for another day.
But it needed to be said.
But, you know, it's just saying that the doctrine of preexistence really did influence a lot of things. And if you go to EFY today, they will still talk about the youth being born in the church being a special chosen breed, that these were the generals in the preexistence. So the same doctrine that would explain away why some people are born into really crappy circumstances, that's become politically incorrect to say, but the reverse side, which implies that, is still taught. The people born into good LDS homes in Sandy, Utah are that way because they were the more valiant spirits in the preexistence. That is still openly taught.
Yeah.
Sounds like the reasoning of men, John.
But okay, let me throw this out there because I work with youth. With the youth, they are strongly getting away from the youth were generals in heaven. You are chosen because what ended up happening, that was really, I mean, even through the 80s up through my generation in the 90s and 2000s, that was drilled into us. But now they've realized that they kind of had a group of entitled youth who thought that they were a lot better than they really were. From what I've been able to tell, they're telling them that they were good, strong spirits to come forth in this time, but they're not telling them you were awesome, you were saved for this exact
chosen
moment.
Generation.
They're getting away from that.
I thought they said that in conference, this last conference.
They might be trying to get away with it, but if I have missions on this podcast, one of them is the church can't suddenly say, oh, well, we were doing that up until last Thursday, but we're not doing it now, so you can't bring it up. I mean, the church is the sum total of everything. The church tells me that if I didn't repent for something I did when I was 13, I'm still carrying that around. Same goes back at you guys. You can't just stop doing something like in 2004 and say, oh, that's so behind us. That's so yesterday. You know, you have to take ownership of that unless the church turns it around. And the church doesn't like to turn around. They don't like to come up and say, guys, this is our new conference talk. We're really sorry. We've been saying this really stupid thing for about 80 years now, and we just have to back off. No, so they just hopes it goes away. And it doesn't, because we know that people still in the church today still believe in blood atonement, even though that hasn't been taught openly for 120 years, because there's never been a really good, oh, sorry, we did teach that, and it's wrong, it's not true.
Well, look, as far as the youth thing goes, and the fact that, okay, they're not doing that anymore, how much of that was also from overzealous EFY counselors who were wanting to act cool and give these kids something amazingly awesome, some little nugget that they were going to go home with? Because I had some of those, and I don't know, even at 16, 17 years old, I just laughed at them and said, you're putting on an act.
And thus goes Mormonism. I mean, Mormonism is just a sum total of the teachings of its members. And we're going to talk about the great apostasy here in a minute. Yeah. All right. Forward ho. You give me hand signals.
Oh,
what are you trying to tell me?
I was just trying to tell you that you're yelling.
Well, remember our tough task?
I know. I told John he was yelling at me in the tub, and then when I went to edit that podcast, I could not even hear myself, and he was fine. So
right. It sounded like you recorded that in the tub from Harry Potter.
Okay, let's see. Number six. Eden and Zion in the United States and American exceptionalism. Of course, American exceptionalism is not uniquely a Mormon idea. It's the idea that America is special and has a special case and has a special place in the world.
God's heart.
It is still very, very extremely prominent among especially Republicans and the right. And it plays out in American politics in that we say things like, I don't know, the Geneva Convention or War Crime Tribunal should apply to the rest of the world, but not to the United States. that we have a special set of rules. And a lot of the people on the right believe that comes from this divine investiture in the United States. Of course, that teaching is really amped up also in Mormonism. Most or a lot of Mormons believe that, you know, Benjamin Franklin and George Washington are basically prophets and treat them as such.
And Christopher Columbus.
Yeah.
He's mentioned in the Book of Mormon.
So this extreme patriotism mixed in with Mormonism is very prevalent, and it shows up most prevalent in the special, unique American doctrines. We already mentioned Christ in America, although it's unclear whether that's Christ just somewhere in the New World versus the United States. The Meldrumites and those would say it was the United States because they actually do get into American exceptionalism. But you have Eden appearing in the United States in Missouri, just a little bit north of Kansas City. And, of course, Zion, the place where Jesus will return and the gathering point, being really close to the same place. I think Eden is about 12 miles north of Zion, isn't it? These are extremely – I mean, nobody else believes this.
And we'll say, I should point out in, you know, I'll speak for Brant here, I guess, or I'll speak for myself, but this is one that is definitely in the Book of Mormon, that the land of America was this chosen, you know, reserved place where all of this was going to happen in the latter days. That was all part of God's plan. So in the Mormon view, not only is America special now, but it's been special for, you know, back thousands and thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Book of Mormon says that no one will be led to the New World except by the hand of God. So if you take that literally, you'd say anybody who comes here, be it through Ellis Island or through the Bering Straits, was led here especially to be here because this land is set apart from all the other lands.
Well, I mean, it's got more religious freedom than other lands. Oh boy, here we go.
I mean, I don't know about that.
Okay, what other place would have more religious freedom?
Well,
what about Norway?
Still, we're in the top five.
It's possible.
I think if you take like Europe, America has basically equal religious freedom. America has some things that it leads on and others that doesn't. Here, I'll give you one that's a pet peeve of mine. If I run, let's say, I don't know, some sort of beanery. I have a secular beanery. It is specifically said that I cannot discriminate based on religion.
Why would you want to?
Oh, well, that's an American thing. I cannot say I don't want to hire Muslims, for example. But if I run a beanery and the religion owns the beanery, the U.S. law specifically says that religions are free to discriminate based on religion. So when the church runs all these for-profit entities, they can, in fact, they have an exception to that rule. So to me, that's not really religious freedom. It's pretty free. But, you know, the church can, I could apply to work as a janitor at BYU, something that ostensibly has nothing to do with religion. I'm scrubbing toilets. And they can say, we refuse to hire you because you are an ex-Mormon. And that's perfectly legal. Where if I was to apply to be a janitor at the public library, that would be expressly illegal. So I don't think you can just say, oh, America's the land of tolerance, because it's not always the case.
Well, I didn't say it was tolerant. I said there's a lot of religious freedom. Look, they can kind of, I mean, they're a church. They can kind of make some of their own choices.
Yeah.
Right. So religions have freedom, but they might have more freedom than the general population.
I think in the United States, we're free from a state religion, or generally so. I think that's not. But we still have things like the president's prayer breakfast or whatever the heck they do down there, things like that I'd like to see go.
That's true.
But yeah, I mean, this is general. But I don't think you can say that's, I mean, let's get back on target. We're talking about American exceptionalism. I don't think that makes us pretty exceptional. I think. You know,
that's pretty normal for modern
the Netherlands. You're still pretty
countries.
Pretty free with your religion. You know,
yeah.
You could say, well, they have an actual state-sponsored religion. That's true, but you know, we have the National Cathedral and this sort of state-sponsored, watered-down Protestantism that shows up everywhere. So you could definitely make the case as an agnostic that the United States has a state religion and it's sort of mamby-pamby Protestantism.
But. Definitely.
Well, and I'll throw a bone your way. this also was very much a product of 1800s. We are America. We just came out of the Revolutionary War. We are, you know, we are free, and all this other stuff that they were going to change from England. So that also probably played a pretty big factor as well.
Yeah.
Right. Go read Thomas Paine, anything by Thomas Paine, and you'll the nationalism just bleeds through. And then you read, you know, a lot of this Mormon stuff, and it's just the same flavor of you know, super U.S. nationalism that was prevalent in the early 1800s and, you know, early American. It was just in the environment.
Well, I think this doctrine is probably the one that on everything on the list. Well, maybe this one's the second most likely to go. I think first, the one that's most likely to go is number one. But this one has a really uneasy tension because there's still a lot of people in a lot of power in the church that hold on to this American exceptionalism and the special place of the United States, a la Glenn Beck and Skousen and things like the painter John McNaughton and some of those guys who get airplay outside of the Mormon corridor, and you know that gets picked up by the John Birchers and other extreme right wingists. So there's a lot of that stuff getting pumped out of Utah and out of the Mormon culture.
Yeah, and now the church has more members outside of the United States than they do inside of the United States. So preaching that America is, you know, God's country is maybe a little less tasteful.
Yes. That's why I think there's tension, because there's still some people who grew up during the Benson years and the post, you know, the Cold War, when all that was really, the Mormons were really high on that stuff. And so they still came of age in that age. They're still in charge of the church, but it's really something. If you look at international stuff, like there's two Mormonisms, there's the international Mormonism that gets translated, and then there's the Mormonism at home, and they sort of try to edit it out a little bit, you know?
Yeah. I think they try to put on they try to be sensitive to other people's cultures and countries.
A little bit more. Yeah, a little bit more. They still require Africans to sing with organ music. Okay. Any other thoughts on Eden? We skipped over those. I think Eden and Zion are becoming an embarrassment for a lot of Mormons.
Did you guys hear about what happened on Fox News Memphis with a guy named Ben Ferguson?
No.
Yes.
No.
He went out, and again, this is Fox News Memphis. He went out and was going out basically asking people, would you ever vote for someone who believes that the Garden of Eden was right here in America? Would you ever vote for someone who believes that? And everyone was shocked. And when he told them it was Mitt Romney, and it was actually featured on Politico. And surprisingly enough, there was a lot of people coming after Ferguson saying, this is not real reporting. So there is some sympathy for Romney and this type of belief, but I could see this kind of being shuffled under the carpet a little bit.
Well, I think if Romney or any of the others become a presidential candidate, I mean, become a real contender, you'll see a lot of these doctrines. This will change the church drastically, because mm-hmm. Romney will say something like, that was a 19th century belief. It's not really something we hold anymore. And bang, that'll become the truth.
Well, it's kind of like God living near Kolob. It's something that Mormons believe, but it's not really important to the doctrines of the church. I mean, you know, the Garden of Eden in Missouri or Kansas, it really doesn't have anything to do with what Mormons do and worship. And
that's a great segue to number five, because number five is probably my pet peeve. Number five is the great apostasy. Of course, it's not the idea of apostasy is not fully unique to Mormonism. The whole Protestant Reformation was based somewhat on the idea of apostasy, but Mormonism sort of amped it up to 11. And
well, yeah, part of it was that the Protestants said, okay, well, there was this falling away, but let's come together, use our minds, and pray and try to figure out what God really wants for us.
The Reformation was about a reformation. It's about the church has sort of drifted away from some of the fundamental teaching. It's time to get back to the fundamentals.
Right. But for the Mormons, they needed a prophet that spoke to God in the flesh, Like, it was much more dramatic.
Yeah, the whole thing was corrupt from the base. And we're going back to 19th century Mormonism a little bit, but 19th century Mormonism is very clear that Mormons taught that the churches were all run by the devil. So it wasn't just a reformation that was necessary. The whole system that the church, the passage from the Book of Mormon about the horror of the world. I mean, they literally taught that was the Catholic Church. And in the temples up until 1990, you know, that the Protestant minister who appeared in the temple ceremony was revealed to be an agent for pay to Satan. So the church, it wasn't just this, hey, we've drifted astray. This is Protestantism and Catholicism. We're the church of the devil. We're completely the enemy.
Right. And I think playing into this is the need for a prophet to kind of lead God's church. I mean, other religions also have said, oh, this guy's a prophet. But for some reason, they usually like turn extremely cultish and like kill themselves or, you know, something bizarre like that. Mormonism has this prophet concept and they're, you know, they've got stick-to-itiveness. I mean, they're sticking around.
Yeah, yeah. And I think to underline your point, the great apostasy is a necessary doctrine to explain Joseph Smith. I think because it was so bombastic and so negative to other religions, the church tries to distance itself from these teachings today, but they are requisite to the whole principle of the foundation.
Yeah.
And they're still taught in missionary discussions as well. It's de-emphasized a little bit, but it's just taught that there was a falling away and an apostasy.
Right.
And I think to really understand the apostasy, you have to understand the Mormon idea that priesthood isn't something that you are called to or something that, you know, you feel and then you go and do service. It's like something that you actually receive from someone else. And if you haven't actually had that person's hands laid on your head and had it given to you, then you have no authority from God, which in other churches, that just isn't the case.
Right. Yes. For Protestant
so
churches.
So as soon as that's gone from your country or from your region or off the earth, then everybody's screwed.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but
no matter how good your heart is or how hard you work or how hard you pray.
Catholicism still has the principle of ordination, as do others, but you know,
but that special power of the priesthood, I don't think
take the Catholics, for example. They thought they had the priesthood, but if they actually didn't, then it's all just a farce.
Well, you could say the same thing about the Mormon Church, because obviously, obviously, thinking you have the priesthood is not sufficient grounds for having it, because you can't tell if you have it or not, right?
Right, but in order to understand, I agree with you. My only point is that in order to understand the Mormon version of the apostasy, you can't think of it like a Protestant would think of it.
True.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. But oftentimes when we use the apostasy, there's a sleight of hand, and that's they kind of switch back and forth between talking about Protestants and Catholics as if they're the same, and they'll use Protestants to prop up one side of the argument and Catholics to prop up the other side, when the argument in total doesn't apply equally to both, because you have a continuum of authority with the Catholic Church. And then some will point out, yeah, but you have corrupt popes or whatever that breaks the chain. And then I can point out that there was Brigham Young, and then they say, oh, that's just Brigham. You know, so, or you can point out just really crazy ass stuff that other prophets, seers, and revelators saying, oh, well, that was just 19, that was just common sense of the time, and they were just teaching men and blah 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 blah. You know, like this is why I say this is my pet peeve, because whatever weapon you form to take down the other churches with the great with the great apostasy can equally be turned back. If you take Talmadge's hallmark book on the subject, Great Apostasy, and you just flip that book, everything in that book applies to the Mormon Church. And
or
so
it could be
my, you know, my argument would be you cannot believe in the Great Apostasy and
the idea that the prophet will never lead the church astray.
Right. Anything that you use to prop up the Great Apostasy other than just saying it's there can equally be used to dismantle the Mormon Church. And then so you can't believe in the continuum of the Mormon Church and the Great Apostasy at the same time, therefore you can't believe in the Mormon Church. Ergo, the Mormon Church is false. End of story. Podcast is over. We're done.
Well, there you go.
No, pack it all
it
up.
It doesn't mean that it's false. It just means that people should apply the same kind of thinking and the possibility that it could be an apostasy.
Right.
And I think that as Mormonism comes more and more into the mainstream, we might see this de-emphasized in the sense that you can't go out there saying, well, there's this apostasy and the Mormon church was built. But guess what? If that's the case, then everyone else is wrong, because that's very bombastic. And while that might have worked in isolated Utah, the isolated Utah time period up until like the 1940s and 50s, it's not going to work now, especially with more and more Mormons becoming more and more prominent. You can't have that kind of rhetoric going out.
Well, if you just look right at the arc of Mormonism, you know, at the height of the teaching of the Great Apostasy, a lot of those doctrines that mark Mormonism have been abandoned. And we've been on this slow, like 110-year march into mainstream Protestantism. Till you have, you know, Hinckley saying, I don't know that we teach that. And just trying to, you know, saying things like God is omnipresent. You know, you'll find that in Mormon teachings today. And so if they're in apostasy, then why in the hell do we every year get closer and closer to them? We're not moving away from them. We're sounding more and more like them.
That's true.
Well, I think part of the church coming, the church becoming mainstream and wanting to take on some of these things that say, see, we're not so different, is because they separated themselves. They went to Utah, they developed, they flourished, and then they realized, wait a minute, we're isolating ourselves. And now they're trying to at least find commonality where they can say, see, we're kind of similar on this. But that being said, just because they're going to de-emphasize some things doesn't mean they're going to completely get rid of things. And I think that Mormonism is going to continue to be its own unique brand of religion. Just I don't think it's going to keep going down until we're exactly like Protestantism.
I don't understand the concept of de-emphasism. Because if you take like physics, there's nowhere like the College of American Physicists. Is there a College of American Physicists? I don't know. They don't sit around and say, we need to de-emphasize this particular, you know, theorem. You don't even see like Methodists doing that, saying, oh, you know, there's this stuff we need to de-emphasize because it's not sitting well with everybody else. What is this de-emphasis?
It's not an active choice where you're going to go out there and say, all right, from this point on, we're not going to talk about this. But they're just not talking about that subject as much. I mean, they're not getting up there in conference and talking about the great apostasy every single time like they've done in the past. They're choosing to emphasize other things instead of that
one
issue.
But I'm saying there's a whole pile of stuff that we de-emphasize today.
And that we totally
everybody
ignore.
Does that, though. Whether you're in business, whether you're in government, whether you're in religion, everyone does that.
Yeah, but does that make it right?
I don't know. I mean, personally, I sit there and say, you know what? We need to quit. For me, for my own personal brand of Mormonism, I sit there and say, we need to quit putting ourselves as an us against the world type mentality. And we need to understand that some of these concepts and doctrines out there, while we still hold true to them, we don't need to go out there and air it for everyone to know.
But isn't that the church's mission, like one of its missions?
To what?
To proclaim the gospel.
Proclaim the gospel, yes. To bring people closer to Christ and closer to God, yes. To go out there and say that there was an apostasy and that means all of you are wrong, that's not what they're out there trying to do.
But and same thing with everything. If that's the true narrative, though, I mean, if that's really what happened in history, then shouldn't the church just kind of stand by that and go with it? I mean, bombastic or not, or arrogant or not, if that's what happened, then I don't know.
But what purpose would that have to come out and say, well, this happened and we're going to let you know before you join our religion? Because again, you could do the same thing with the United States. Go try telling a group of fifth graders who are saying the Pledge of Allegiance how the Pledge of Allegiance actually started.
They probably should.
Yeah, why not?
Why? Because it's become a symbol of national unity.
A false?
Maybe to the right.
Unity, maybe? I don't know. That's kind of...
Anyway, I get your point, but I disagree with it. I think the people should be given sort of access to all information. I'm more of a internet modern, you know, it's out there. And I would say the reason like physicists teach, you know, like Newtonian physics first year, it's not because they're trying to hide like Einsteinian physics. It's that you really have to have a good grasp of the one to get to the other. But the other is out there. It's not like they say, if like a student asks about Einsteinian physics, not like say, we de-emphasize that. Don't need to worry about it. They'll say, well, you got to understand this first to understand the other. And so the difference between that, I would say, is by the time you get in your second year of physics, your third year of physics, they're saying, okay, this is where Newtonian physics is wrong. And it works in, you know, for shooting cannonballs, but it doesn't really work for things that are very small and very large. The difference between that and the Mormon Church is you're always taking physics 101 forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And every time you bring up that other stuff, they say, we need to really concentrate on faith and scriptures. You know, we're the milk before meat. So that's where I see the fundamental difference is they keep de-emphasizing this stuff even for the insiders. Because there are people who've been in the church for 50 years who have legitimate questions about polygamy. And the church won't answer them, refuses to. So, you know.
And it also seems unfair to not, or to kind of gloss over some things that might be uncomfortable for investigators until after they're baptized. And then, you know, and then they find out and then they're disappointed or they're shocked. Why not just tell them those things up front and then they can decide if they want to be part of it or not?
So wait a minute. So you're saying that when we have someone that's potentially interested in this religion, okay, before we even get before we even start discussing baptism and would you like to be a part of it, we need to sit down and have a separate lesson that says, by the way, you're going to encounter all these different things about our religion, so we're going to sit down here and let you know.
Yeah, before you ask them to be baptized, I think that would be fair.
I think they should explain whether or not the church believes in polygamy. They should explain what the endowment is and that you have to do that before you can get into heaven.
Because if you just teach a Protestant-type religion and then ask them to get baptized, why wouldn't they? If they didn't know a lot about the Mormon Church, what reason would they have to not be baptized if they already kind of had a Protestant belief in Jesus Christ?
Well, if that's the case, then we should have our investigators take a 5-year journey as to learning about every single thing about the church. Because you can't sit down with an investigator day one and explain to them 5 minutes about this is what our temple endowment ceremony is.
I wouldn't do it day one.
But you know what I'm saying, though. I mean, because you're saying before you get baptized, you should know all these things. But if you're going to do it that way, you're going to have them come to church for 5 years so they can actually have some sort of a solid ground to understand where some of these things, like the temple, is coming from.
I'll give you an example. Before we joined a Unitarian. Now, when you join a Unitarian congregation, you join the individual congregation. You don't join, like, the overall society.
A worldwide church.
But when we joined the Wilmington, we were out in Wilmington, North Carolina, they had a class that you had to you could not join the congregation until you took this class. And you could come and ask them to, and they say, you have to take the class. They taught the class about once every quarter or so. So they'd say, yeah, just keep coming. So there'd be this implication. You had to keep coming to church for a while. And then you take the class, and it was like 4 weeks, and there were 3 or 4 hours each or something like that.
On Saturdays,
On Saturday. They had childcare there, so you could sit through it. And we learned all about the history of the church. Good things, bad things. We learned about the fundamentals of the doctrine, you know, and they would recommend other readings. There was no like, well, we're going to give you the introduction, then we really want you to join. So, yeah, the church could do something like that, saying, yeah, we have this class. You know, Mormonism is much more complicated than Unitarianism by a long shot.
Yeah.
So saying, you got to understand this stuff, and we want you to go to church for a year and then take this class, and then we'll talk about baptism.
Yeah, why hurry everybody into baptism?
I got in trouble on my mission for not challenging people to get baptized on the second time I met them. The mission president.
Well, you're not alone in that.
And so I mean the church wants to push people in. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, early in my faith crisis, like real early, the missionaries in my ward called me and asked me to come help them teach an investigator because I spoke his language that I learned on my mission. And so I was, you know, reluctant, but I went and met with this guy a couple times, and then he ended up getting baptized. And about 2 months later, he pulls me aside at church and says, hey, I've heard this and this and this and this and this, and goes through, you know, 10 things that are really challenging to anybody who's in the church. And he was devastated. True story, happened to me a couple years ago, and he never came back to church again. He loved the church. He liked the people there. He liked the missionaries, but nobody told him what he was getting into.
Right.
And then he gets baptized, and his family's like, don't you know they're a cult? Like, what, you know, temple, and there's polygamy. And he didn't know anything.
Right, just sounded like a nice Jesus.
Yeah, he just thought it was a great church. Everybody was super nice to him. You know, there's this Book of Mormon thing that's a little bit weird, but he didn't know anything other than that. He just thought it was a regular Christian church.
Right, and I've heard a lot of people make the same complaint. And it doesn't help the church.
I still have guilt over that. I feel horrible for what happened to him.
It doesn't help the church at all.
Yeah, the church shouldn't baptize another person until it can explain what their current stand on polygamy is. Okay, moving forward. Number four, speaking of polygamy, the literal need for ordinances. Ordinances for the dead and Mormon belief on faith and works. I'm going to start backwards and say faith and works because Mormons sort of have a unique view here. It is more Catholic than Protestant, which is you have to have faith and you have to have these key ordinances, these key works have to literally be done. They are not a figurative thing that shows your devotion to Christianity or to God. They, even if you were a full, we hinted at this earlier, if you were a full believer at any time in history and you were not born in the era of Mormonism, you have to have somebody come and do those works for you in proxy. So the ordinances are of such importance, they literally have to be done in a set and prescribed way, and there is no salvation outside of that.
Yep.
And so ordinances for the dead, which we already talked about, is done in the temples only.
Now, goes currently. I mean, there was a long period of time, 30 or 40 years, where they were done outside.
Yeah, when they didn't really have access to a temple.
Well, I mean, you're giving a back read. There's no like doctrine. There's no doctrine anywhere that says ordinance of the dead have to be performed in the temple.
No, but it's, if I remember correctly, in Nauvoo, when they were doing ordinances for the dead, like in a river, they said, you know, when the temple is done, we will move them there. They were building a font in the temple. That was the intent, is to have them done in the temple.
Right. Well, I mean, let's take something like ceilings, living ceilings. They were done outside the temple until like 1904.
That's true.
And probably afterwards, you know. So, you know, like the church says, this is a doctrine. It's not really a doctrine. I mean, it is a policy, right?
A policy? It is a doctrine. I think it is a doctrine. This is something that I don't know. It's what we do.
But the idea that it has to be done in a temple is the policy.
So I mean, all those ceilings that were done by sealers and prophets, seers, and revelators up in Canada and down in Mexico, they weren't done in any temples. Anyway, that's a side issue.
But the need for them is
the literal
the
need for ordinances. Yes,
that is the doctrine.
I agree.
And my honorable mention kind of plays in here, which is the need to be adopted into the 12 tribes. That you have to be part either literally or adopted in to be saved.
Yeah. You know, we talk about sealings mostly in terms of marriage, and then, you know, in terms of polygamy and stuff. But sealing is important to connect the chains of people to you know, you get sealed to your mother and father, or in the case of, you know, 19th century, they would adopt into other people. So people would be, you know, like
sealed to Brigham Young.
Sealed to Brigham Young or sealed to Joseph Smith or whatever. And then all sealed back to through Abraham into Adam.
Right. To have the whole family of men, at least the righteous ones, sealed together.
Yeah, and that has to be done for your salvation. Okay, any other thoughts on the literal need for ordinances? I mean, there's not a lot to say here. It's just clearly a Mormon ideal, and you know, it stands in stark contrast to Protestantism. You know, there's others who teach the literal need for baptism, but it's usually as a outward manifestation of an inward state.
So I think that we should list the ordinances that are actually required, that Mormons feel are required for salvation. So you already mentioned baptism.
And let's go from birth to death to do the ones that aren't also. We can do it in the same list.
Okay.
So there's naming, because these have to be done by the priesthood, right? There's
naming and blessing of newborns,
which is not required.
Right. And then there's the baptism.
Baptism is required.
And the confirmation
is required.
Which is where the newly baptized member, it gets a blessing that they receive the Holy Ghost.
There's
literally.
Blessing a home is not required. Blessing the food is not required.
No.
There's priesthood manuals from as short as 10 years ago that have exorcisms in it. That's not required. Well, then for men, they have to get the Aaronic priesthood, to get ordained to be a deacon, a teacher, a priest. So the Aaronic priesthood, the Melchizedek priesthood. And then in the temple,
you get sealed.
Well, first you get your washing and anointing.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm. Washing and anointing, that's required, right?
Yes. And then the endowment.
The endowment is basically a ceremony that you do, and that's where the movie is involved.
Right. And then there is, between that and the ceiling, there is, for women, being passing through the veil.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is that really required?
It's required. They don't want you to get married till you do it.
Wow. Okay. There's a veil in the temple that's figurative.
And her husband pulls her through.
Passing mm-hmm. into the and celestial kingdom.
That's another topic for another day. Then there is the ceiling to the spouse.
Which is required for women to be saved, but not for men.
Men could be sealed to multiple women.
But men don't have to be sealed to a woman to be saved.
Correct. A woman has to, and this is a sort of a doctrine in transition, but a woman has to be sealed to a man to be saved.
Right.
And then there, you have to be sealed to your parents. And if you're...
You don't have to be sealed to your parents to be saved.
I think that's a saving ordinance.
No.
I think eventually it's your Abrahamic thing. Should we get Mike Tannehill on here?
Yeah, well, you need Mike for that one.
You have to be, how does that work?
You have to be sealed into the priesthood lines. I think it is a saving ordinance.
I don't know. I don't think it is. But Mormons get this special blessing, and then they're declared to be in one of the 12 tribes, which is like their adoption into the 12 tribes.
Now, don't they make you get your patriarchal blessing before you go through the temple?
I don't know if they make you.
Not really, because, I mean, even though my mom's a convert, she got hers 10 years ago, and she's been through the temple for the last 30 years.
Yeah, uh-huh. I think it's an option. It's not required.
Okay. I don't think the patriarchal blessing where you get declared into a kingdom or otherwise.
Not a kingdom, but a tribe.
A tribe. I don't think that's required. But the adoption, a.k.a. sealing to parents, I think is.
That doesn't seem...
But doesn't that happen?
Reasonable.
Wouldn't that happen through birth? I mean, I don't know how it would work if you're Mormon, but your parents aren't.
Once you are, once your parents are sealed, if you're born that way, you're considered born in the covenant, and you automatically get that from birth. But if that's not the case, you know, like when they do temple work for the dead, they seal them to their parents.
Yeah.
And that also happens
if an adoption happens where it's someone outside of the covenant.
If an adoption happens, then they'll do it.
Is there anything else after those things in the temple until the time that you die?
No.
I was going to say, wouldn't it be the burial?
The burial has, there's a lot of things that the priest, you have to have the priesthood to do, like to dedicate a grave and all that kind of stuff. They're not really saving ordinances.
Yeah,
it's
but
just
to
really,
come forth in the first resurrection, don't you have to have your garments on and your grave blessed?
It's not required. No? So the required ones are baptism, confirmation, priesthood for men, sealing to parents, and sealing to your spouse.
For women.
And the endowment and the washing anointing. Then there's argument whether the second anointing is required or not.
So where do the garments fit in here?
Well, the garments are part of the washing and anointing.
So they're just part of that ordinance for a reminder of that ordinance for the rest of your life, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but I think that's a sufficient
answer. That's a good summary.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Okay. So number three, celestial marriage, which is, of course, an ordinance, but it once again, these are the top 10 unique things to Mormonism, because Mormonism has taken something that most religions are very much behind. And, you know, you could argue that marriage and presiding over the family like that is one of the chief cultural functions of religion. And Mormonism has really amped that up. And that's where we were arguing before about being left out of the temple, because you have to be married in the temple. If you're married outside of the temple for whatever reason, let's say you were married before you become a Mormon, they will redo your marriage. They'll redo the sealing in the temple after you've been a Mormon for a year or so.
Right.
And
so marriage has always been seen as a holy kind of religious rite.
In almost every culture, I think it is pretty, mm-hmm. you know, if you have religion, it's going
it's
to
tied
be evolved
into the religion.
To marriage.
But Mormons amp it up with the temple ceremony and the sealing.
Go ahead.
And not only that, but the marriage itself is sort of the springboard for your afterlife. I mean, if the Mormon afterlife is procreation and new creation of new life, you know, it's kind of a fertility theology where your marriage is what creates your celestial afterlife. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't have that kind of procreative or you know, that ceiling here on earth, then really what's the point in living forever?
Yeah, I like that. So I think that's true. The way Mormons today define the afterlife is to take the the fundamental purpose of marriage and extend that on an eternal line. So basically, one man.
Oh.
Let's put that on the table for a minute. A man and a woman together who do the functions of a marriage. They have children. They raise children, spiritual children, and they keep doing that forever. It's that on an eternal timeline.
And they hang out together, and they're romantic for forever with each
right.
other.
But
it's very kind of fairy tale-ish.
And I do believe that the doctrine of celestial marriage as the plurality of women for one man has never been repudiated. And I can show you instances in just recent years by people who are still alive in the quorum who have reaffirmed it, that the Mormon belief is that men will have multiple women
or at least
sealed
can,
to them.
Can have.
I would say that the idea that will and necessarily will has never been repudiated, that it's necessary for salvation that men have multiple wives. You cannot find me any reliable source saying otherwise. I challenge anybody out there.
I'm not going to take that challenge.
That I'm tired of the pussyfooting around. Okay, the Mormon Church believes in polygamy. It still does. It never has stopped. It never will stop. That there it's not a question out there. It's just that we're not practicing it right now.
Yeah, we don't believe in marrying multiple women that you live with currently.
Unless one of them, you know, if the woman dies. You know, but even something like a man and a woman get a divorce, like they go down to the courthouse and get a divorce, and then the man marries another woman, he can get sealed to that woman, the second woman, without the first woman's permission. But the first woman can't get sealed to another man unless she gets permission from the church.
I thought they just changed it in the recent church, the manual of instructions, that they both need permission from the other one.
Maybe they have. I don't know.
No, it's not. They're making it easier on women, but it's still the men can go get it, could go out and get sealed immediately.
So there's still a distinction between the men and the women.
It's just, and we could go through all the evidences. There's all these little things in the manual. It's still there. It's still practiced. It's still believed. And it's a fundamental part of the doctrine. Mormons believe in polygamy. Let's be clear.
All right. So that was celestial marriage.
All right. Number two, Jesus and God as two separate beings and Jesus as Jehovah. Of course, this was a later development, 1837, 1838. You know, the earliest accounts like of the first vision do not have this doctrine in there. But it is very key and it's very unique to Mormonism. Now, it is difficult for Mormons and for others, even outside of Christianity, to understand the concept of the Trinity. But this is a rejection of Trinitarianism in that God the Father and Jesus Christ are not the same being at all, nor have they ever been. There was a time, in fact, when God the Father existed and Jesus Christ or Jehovah as his pre-earthly self, Jehovah didn't exist as a spiritual being. He was an intelligence, an offspring of God, just like the rest of us are.
Right. And we're going to have an upcoming, hopefully we're going to have an upcoming episode on the book, Who Wrote the Bible? One of the interesting points that the author makes in there is that the distinction between Elohim and Jehovah wasn't a distinction between two separate people, but it's a distinction between the word that two different authors used to describe the same person, more or less.
Yeah. So Mormons take Elohim
as two different cultures. And so Joseph Smith took that, you know, this artifact of Old Testament mishmash and turned it into a doctrine that he then, you know, used to show like, well, hey, look, we're going back to the old stuff. This, look at the Old Testament. This is how it used to be.
Yeah.
Right. But even in the Book of Mormon, it has a part where it's Trinitarianism in there that.
Right. Especially in the 1830 edition.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a little bit of a weird doctrine. So maybe we should walk our way through it a bit. When the world was created, it was God the Father, and I have to say that this doctrine profoundly changed around the turn of the century. So what I'm about to say was not as it was completely different in 1870. But
you're explaining what it is today.
I'm explaining the Talmage doctrine, which is the one that's adopted by the church today. So God the Father set up Jehovah
Elohim is God the Father,
Elohim, according to God the Father, who is the father of all of our spirits, set up Jehovah, his firstborn, as sort of the chief
God for this world.
Individual God of this world. And he created the world, and although he was not a perfect being, and he had never had a body, somehow he became a God. And
he was a perfect being. That's why he became a God.
He was not a being because he didn't have a body yet,
He was a spirit, and a spirit has substance, according to Mormons.
But we're told we have to get a body in order to become a God, and he never did that.
Okay, yeah. In order to be perfected, you have to have a resurrected body.
Okay,
so I see what you're saying.
So anyway, when people in the Old Testament time, before Jesus Christ was born, prayed to God, they were actually praying to Jehovah, Jesus. They didn't have direct access to Elohim. And all of the pronouncements in the Old Testament were from the Spirit God, Jehovah, who had yet to be born into the world and attain a body. Once Jesus Christ was born, he ceased to be the God of this world and became the Savior of the world. And now all of our prayers go directly to Elohim without the intercessory. Jehovah, Jesus, is no longer serving in that role. So Mormons today, when they pray to God, or when they invoke the name of God, they are not invoking Jesus Christ. They are specifically not praying to Jesus Christ.
Right, but they still need to say his name in order to get to God the Father, because it's like the code word for our world. So God knows like where the prayer is coming from or something. Uh-huh. So you have to say in the name of Jesus Christ at the end of the prayer.
Right, but,
or it doesn't work.
Mormons do not pray to Jesus Christ.
That's true, but the Old Testament people did.
Jesus Christ cannot forgive people for their sins.
True. But he makes it possible.
Yes. But Jesus Christ did, in the first part of the world history, serve as the forgiving God, because he says sometimes, you know, I forgive, or I do that sort of stuff.
Did he ever forgive in the Old Testament? I thought he was just like mean and violent.
So you've got...
No, he would forgive the prophet when he'd go sleep with somebody, I think.
Oh.
So this is where Mormons really depart. Jehovah to Mormons is not God. That's a different person. It's Jesus Christ.
That's true.
But Jesus
is a God.
Yes.
Yeah. When I was on my mission, I had a companion who actually decided to strike up a relationship with the local Jehovah's Witnesses. And so we were actually taking the Jehovah's Witnesses discussions. And this was one of the things we couldn't get past this, the whole concept of who God was and who Jesus Christ was, because of the Mormon view of it and Jehovah's Witnesses and other religions of the world.
So like you guys had a hard time understanding what the heck they were talking about because your view was so different. Is that what you mean?
Look, I'll admit, I was a young, brash missionary who was ready to put these Jehovah's Witnesses in their place, and they actually brought out a lot of the stuff that you're saying about Elohim and about Jehovah and stuff like that. And of course, I'm sitting here saying, "Well, that's no. We have the truth." And then I got home and I started researching and realized I wasn't exactly correct.
Well, you know, I made fun of like the three kingdoms of glory. To me, that's a natural progression. That's a doctrine that sort of makes sense. This whole Jehovah Elohim mismatch, and you have to understand that this was a response to Brigham Young's Adam God nonsense. None of this makes any sense at all. You can't hammer out a sensible cosmology out of this stuff. It's just weird.
Yeah, but the Trinity doesn't make sense, and it's just weird.
Trinity sort of makes sense.
It doesn't make sense to me. But
God, how does it make sense?
Well, God's an omnipresent, omniperfect, omni-whatever being. He can do whatever he wants, right?
So a part of him became Jesus?
Sure, like the avatars of Vishnu, you know, like Krishna.
Oh.
He was...
Okay, if you say it like it's an avatar, I guess I can kind of...
Oh, I kind of get it. Oh, now it makes sense. God forms himself and comes down in a human form.
So then who was he praying to when he was saying...
Look, I don't want to be the defender of religious sort of
No, you stepped
pokey.
Into it, John. Take it all the way.
I don't buy into any of this stuff.
Take it, John.
I think that, for Mormon, what I think is ironic is Mormons say, ha, 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 the Trinity is so nonsensical. Look what we have in return. Let's just agree that they're equally nonsensical.
Yeah. I mean, if you read all of the scriptures, it's hard to make sense of the God as being one, like whatever. I mean, it's hard to make sense of whatever that is.
And there's some, if you take this Jehovah as Jesus, different from Elohim as God, there are some passages of Scripture, even some passages in the Doctrine and Covenants, which get really, really screwball.
Yeah. But right. in the New Testament, when
Joseph
Jesus...
Joseph Smith couldn't keep it straight all the time.
Yeah.
Well, they try to explain it in the temple, actually, which is something that they should take out of the temple and explain to everybody. The idea of the temple, and this is not one of those sacred things, is that it's very sort of corporate. And the top level tells, you know, the CEO tells the executive directors what to do. The executive directors tell the managers what to do. The managers tell the peons what to do. Peons report, and then it reports and reports.
Exactly.
And that's what I hinted at. The temple repeats everything four times. So it tries to explain this by saying, Elohim says to Jehovah, Jehovah, go down and do this. And Jehovah says, it will be done. And then Jehovah goes down and tells his prophet, prophet,
Adam, go do this.
And the prophet says, I will do it. And the prophet comes back and says, I did it. And then Jehovah goes back and says,
Elohim, it
has been done. So the explanation is that Jehovah is merely just carrying out word for word the orders he gets from his file sergeant.
Who is Elohim, God, the main God.
Which is why, I'm saying this, it's going to sound like I'm saying a smart ass sort of thing, but I don't want Mormonism to be true, because the reward, the what we do for the rest of eternity, sounds absolutely miserable. You know, all you're doing is pumping out spirits and obeying completely the orders of those that right above you. You know, there's no creativity. There's no deviation from this endless cycle of reproduction.
That which has been done on other worlds.
And creating all these devils and all these people who are bound to hell endlessly.
Like
in this cycle of, well, you're always creating these sons of perdition, and you're doing exactly, you can't deviate. It has to be exactly the way it was done in the previous worlds. And oh, who wants any part of that? How do you commit celestial suicide?
If the afterlife were like a Mr. Deity episode, then I'd be all for it.
Okay, speaking of which, let's get to number one. The number one, in the eyes of at least me, most unique, most important doctrine of Mormonism is the deification of mankind.
Yeah, but I don't know if we teach that or emphasize it.
But you have to listen to the conference after that, where he says, "I know what we
teach."
Wink, wink, wink. Yeah. So the idea is
this was one of my biggest selling points on my mission.
Did people like it?
Yeah, some people did. When you kind of walk them through it nice and slow, they're like, "Yeah, that makes sense." You know, and we would poo-poo the traditional idea of heaven, like, well, what are we all just going to do? Sit on a cloud and not create anything?
I've said this before. This is Mormonism's crown jewel. This is the best thing they have. This is a brilliant and digestible and understandable doctrine that people can get behind, that we have. And it's fundamentally American. It's fundamentally everything, that you can become something great. You can become a god.
Well, if you are a child of God, then you have some part of that being in you. It's like you're a little God seed. So, I mean, if you think of yourself as a child of God, then it makes sense that you could become like your father, right?
I say to Mormons, lead with this. This is your best thing.
Some people might think it sounds weird, but at least it's something to, shoot for.
When I was a missionary with the Southeast Asians, with the Buddhists, they loved this. This was really harmonious with a lot of Eastern teaching.
Yeah, kind of nirvana.
Well,
perfection of...
No, but the progression and your Buddha nature and all that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, I guess if as a Mormon God, you have a lot of work to do, so it wouldn't be very much like nirvana.
And it explains a lot of things, although it creates a lot of questions too. But, you know, why is there a God? Or where did God come from? You know, why does God care about us? What does it mean when we're created in the image of God? There's all these philosophical questions that this sort of tidies up in a way. Of course, it creates some other problems, but that's true with every religion. So, this is a profoundly cool doctrine.
I am so proud of you right now, John.
I totally agree, John. And when I first started having my faith crisis, and I, you know, after a few days of the research frenzy and figured out, like, okay, this really isn't true, you know, I felt betrayed, but the next thing that I was really disappointed about was, I'm not going to be a god. And that kind of hit me like, oh man, that's like such a letdown, you know?
You gave up the key prize, man.
Right. There's
nothing
it's the big
than
sell. I mean, that's the thing what motivates Mormons is this is the big sell. It's not just, okay, you're going to heaven, you're going to a really good place. It's, you're going to have endless worlds and thrones and principalities and kingdom. You know, it's this whole
and you're power. Going
to expansion of everything you could even imagine.
Right. In terms
times
of
infinity. It's just,
but Mormons take it further. I mean, it's not just like a greedy thing. It's a, you're going to learn everything. You're going to know everything.
Right.
You're going to experience profound love. You're going to experience, you know, the best that the universe has to offer is yours out there. And I would say that for Mormons who have been in a long time, who understand Mormonism, this is a seed of their faith. And why it's missing from the discussions and the church and Hinckley has the gall to say, I don't know that we emphasize that, when it is so important to so many people, it's just mind-blowing. I can't emphasize enough. This is your thing. When they call you the God Makers, say, yes, we are.
Join us.
See, I think, because I was like you, John, I was in Southeast Asia as well. I was in Korea. And they really love it. They think that it's really great. But I think the biggest problem is, over here, in at least in the Western part of the world, that's a very foreign concept that you know, someone could be a god. And they look at it very as blasphemy. That,
right.
How could you say that? How could you say that you are going to be on the same level as God? And that's, I think that's one of the problems, that the reason why we haven't really broadcast it as much as we have.
But it is, it's a foreign idea to evangelicals and say Catholics. And for some reason, we keep trying to get back in bed with those guys. But go to the New Age section of your local bookstore. And there's plenty of people who are interested in this sort of expansive spirituality in the United States. There are some best-selling books in there where this idea is in harmony.
There's a lot of the goddess doctrines.
Yes, absolutely. There are parallel doctrines all over the place, but the church wants to turn its back on those people, and they want the Tea Party people. It's like, forget those douchebags. You got plenty of people who would jive with this if you stop trying to pony up to the right and you look to people who have an expansive spirituality. This is a very leftist idea. Joseph Smith was a spiritual radical, and the church needs to re-embrace that and reinvigorate itself and quit worrying about how many times people pierce their ears and start looking at what is fundamentally that which makes us us. And this is one of those things. It is not about white shirts and obedience and handing out tracts. It is about that Joseph Smith spent 14 years of his life in this spiritual walkabout, in this discovery, that those who were with him felt and understood, and there was this palpable growth and this experience of this newness and tapping back into our souls and our spirits. And here it is, contained in black and white as Joseph Smith left it. And we have abandoned this crap, and we need to re-embrace this crap.
You know what? I got a couple investigators I want you to talk to, because that was awesome.
You have to listen to the whole thing. All ten.
Before you ask them to be baptized.
I mean, let's look at the list again. There's other things that have you know, even something like the temple, which we made fun of here. You know, here is a way to reinvigorate spirituality, to move away from that Protestant, abide with me, fast fall.
You're putting us to sleep. It's too late, John.
Why does that, out of everything in American religion, why is that the one thing we still cling to? That organ pumping out that crap. You can have tambourines. Yeah, I mean,
what about a guitar and some drums?
Whatever, you know, the temple, here's a way to completely reinvigorate spirituality. And, you know, and there's great elements in there, this peacefulness and dressing in white. Why so exclusive? Why tie it to things like who drinks tea and who doesn't? Eden and Zion. Oh, my God, we're here. It's Eden is everywhere. We're there. Zion's here.
No, that's not a great one. But the pre-existence is. That's a cool one.
But then we go to the ordinances. Baptize.
And the no hell is
baptize
great.
Him again, his toe poked out of the water. Oh, could anything be further away from something that's spiritually nourishing, for crying out loud? So,
you guys have any other final thoughts on this top 10 or honorable mention?
Honorable mention of garments, which we touched on a little bit, but the idea that you can, you know, a lot of religions have clothing or some kind of, you know, outward symbol, but Mormons, the idea that you have, you know, the underwear or these things that, that you put on that represent the coat of skins that God gave to Adam, it's just, it's pretty uniquely Mormon.
Right, yeah. And they're hidden. I mean, most religious attire is kind of for show or for, you know, for others to recognize them as that religion. But this one, it's hidden.
I think that's it's an interesting one. One of the reasons I left it off my initial list is because it's really in transition. I mean, even in the last 20 years.
Right.
I think 20 years ago, you would have found a lot more teaching of the protective properties. You know, mm-hmm. that this will literally protect you from harm and violence
and
sickness.
Fire.
And I think this is really in tight transition right now, and it'll be interesting to see where they end up.
Yeah, I don't think that they emphasize that anymore.
You know, I had great-grandparents and great-grandparents who, according to my parents, would never fully take off their garments. It was that symbolic. You know, they would wear them on one arm when they bathed. Now, I've got to remember that 100 years ago, people weren't as into bathing as we are now. But
it was a lot less frequent.
You know, and they were one-piecers, and they had collars. And, you know, now people, even believers, I find, are pretty blasé about their garments.
Well, and now they've made the garments a lot more comfortable and wearable. So people, you know, they'll actually say, you know, I find them comfortable.
Right.
Where you wouldn't have heard them say that 100 years ago.
I know of at least three ex-Mormon women that still wear their garment bottoms because they like them.
Really?
I would if I could get my hands on some.
Yeah, they won't sell them to us anymore. They have a computer that locks you out. You can't just go in and buy them. Okay, any other? I'll give you guys the last word. I've been kind of a...
Gabby?
Yeah.
Gabby.
And kind of bombastic on this one myself.
A little angry, John?
No, I'm not angry.
He's always had a smile on his face the whole time.
No, I'm not angry about it.
You just didn't take your blood pressure medication.
His Xanax or whatever.
No, my favorite thing about Mormonism is the Americanness of it. And I'll say to that point, what I like is the idea of Zion, that we can, you know, create something new, that we can create this wonderful society and something that would, you know, approach perfection. And I think that's kind of tied in with a lot of these points, but something I wish we would see a bit more of. So go ahead, Brant.
I honestly got to say, I was expecting to be dropped down on a little bit more than I was, but, I got to say that the one unique thing that keeps me coming back to Mormonism is these unique doctrines that look, we can go around in circles, whether they're 100% accurate to you or to me or whatever, but they are unique, and they do separate Mormons from the rest of people. And I find it exhilarating to know that there are things like deification and the kingdoms of glory and even temples, something that's really near and dear to my heart, that those are uniquely Mormon, and that's kind of our thing. It's a little bit of a bragging right for me. So,
all right, yeah, I'll take those. Well, as always, if you can think of others you think should have been on the list that we missed out on, or want to add your own comments, the discussion will continue on the website over at MormonExpression.com. Remember, our cruise is coming up in January. So, if you go to our main page over in the top right hand corner, there's a link that will take you to information on the cruise and our wonderful travel agent who will get you all hooked up.
Yeah, and if you want to be in on the birthday spankings, John's birthday is the day the cruise leaves.
Yeah, I'm all for that. And what else? Any other thing we need to? Oh, if you're wondering about the essays, we did get lots of essays entered. We haven't forgotten y'all. We're going to sift through them and we'll have our listener essay. We'll be giving the $100 reward and cobbling them together so you can all listen to the wonderful essays we've had submitted here in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.